Here's my recommendation. I believe today is exactly 9 days before Christmas. Today the 16th? 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24. Here's my recommendation. Sardin and I will say this together. I recommend that we all say the Litany of Humility for this novena before Christmas, each day. If Christmas means anything, one of my favorite definitions of the Incarnation. The Incarnation is the humiliation of God. For as God can humiliate himself, he did so. He couldn't have become a lower creature than man. As St. Paul tells us, he bypassed the angels. And he couldn't have become an irrational animal. In other words, the Incarnation is the humiliation of God. My request then is that all of us will tonight, our closing prayer then, if you don't mind, will be then the Litany of the Humility. I think I mentioned something to you about the author of the Litany of Humility, didn't I, last time? Cardinal Mary del Valle, the secretary of St. Pius X. There would have been no St. Pius X except for Mary del Valle. And one of my hopes is that Mary del Valle himself will one day be canonized. And what it teaches us, you read that Litany of Humility, you realize, if you want to promote the faith, proclaim Christ, you're going to be humiliated, and I mean humiliated, and I mean humiliated. And somebody else will get all the credit, will get all the credit for the good that you've done. You make one mistake, and you'll get all the blame. So this is not just pious exercise. Is that agree then? We're having a novena before Christmas, 9 days. And your assignment for the next 9 days. You men, tell your wives and tell them to remind you in case you forget. Men, I've been getting, and I'm deeply grateful, I've been getting parish bulletins. Here's a batch from different parishes. I really need them for the work that I'm doing for the church, because in many ways the church most reveals herself not so much on the diocesan level, though that too, but mainly on the parish level. And especially because it's in writing. Isn't this delightful? I can't tell you how happy I am. Thank you. And I'll make good use of these. Thank you. Catholic clippings from this is heavily, I can see, on this will be very informative. In fact, people do send me from different cities information what's going on. But my job is not to publicize what they send me, but to put it to the kind of use which the church needs. Thank you. Uh, These are more parish pamphlets from around the country. Thank you. Before we get into our regular course, as we may call it, on the Holy Eucharist, and even more specifically on the Real Presence, I thought I'd share some further thoughts with you on, you know, the hopes and plans for the Ignatian Catechists. And what I see the Ignatian Catechist applies, other things being equal, to the Marianne Catechist too. As I said last week, our Wednesday evening, call them meetings, call them seminars, call them, well, a holy hour and a half. Here before the Blessed Sacrament, and by the way, Cecilia did find copies of St. Augustine's little book, The Teaching. Would you please bring it? There are two editions of it. Unfortunately, both were published by secular publishers. Random House, I think, is one, and Appleton or another secular publisher. And they may be good in shape. I haven't read the translations yet. But I really believe that very early, one of the earliest works of St. Augustine, just shortly after his conversion, I think I told you, dialogue between him and his, shall I say, illegitimate son, is most revealing in that it brings home what I believe anyone who is sharing or teaching the faith of others had better know. The one who is really, really teaching is Christ Himself. Christ Himself really present in the Blessed Sacrament. That's why, well, last night, hour and a half, 2 hours that I spent here in chapel writing. And I put those two lamps on the left side is better for my reading purposes, writing purposes. So Christ present here in the Blessed Sacrament. But Christ is present in us, and that's St. Augustine's thesis. He's present in us by His grace. Not physically, and in humanity. That's precisely what the real presence means. It is the real human presence, or the real presence of the human Christ, who, of course, is the living God become man. These are the two editions. This one is by Appleton and Century. And this is called Concerning the Teacher. And here is the text. This is the text of St. Augustine's writing. And here, another Random House. And here's another translation. And very short, considering the length of Augustine's major works. What I'll do is find out what is the best translation we have available. Neither of these is the Catholic translation, which tells us something, though. And often, when it comes to the fathers of the Church, Protestants can know much more, like the Bible. Well, the fathers of the Church, then we. On one occasion, because I needed the information, I went through the number of quotations of St. Augustine, direct quotation, in John Calvin's classic work called The Institutes of the Christian Religion. Two editions, either one volume or thick, or two volumes, and now over 400 years, that has really done the thinking for the Protestant world. Luther started the Protestant Revolution. Calvin organized it theologically. And Calvin based all of his Calvinism on St. Augustine. And this is where we Catholics can be little children, like babes, centuries and centuries of reading. By now thousands of volumes of commentary by Protestants on the fathers of the church. Thousands. Libraries. And of course what Calvin does with Augustine is he comes, of course, with certain presuppositions. And what Calvin did, and by the way, he's a genius. To understand the Western society, you just must know John Calvin. No, and the only mind that I can think compares with John Calvin's is Thomas Aquinas. Except Thomas Aquinas had the truth. Calvin, sadly, did not. Well, he had the truth. He lost it. He lost it to the seminary. Ever heard of that before? And not an uncommon experience. Of losing one's faith in the seminary. So, to know these great, I'm speaking now of fathers of the church, the great minds, Augustine, he is the greatest of all the fathers of the church. In terms of sheer quantity, I think he wrote the most. In terms of intelligence or penetration, I think he is the greatest of the doctors of the church, or fathers of the church for that matter. There wouldn't be a Thomas Aquinas without Augustine. So that, you know what I'm telling you, to begin to read, and this is, I thought I'd start somewhere. So, and notice how kind I was with just a little, pardon me, teeny bit of patristics in one short sitting. You can read it, I'm sure, in an hour or maybe an hour and a half. And if you're a speed reader, you can read it in less than an hour. And it's by no means, you know, definitive work of Augustine. He wrote that when he was converted. But the purpose of mentioning this, our next meeting is in January. Is that correct? So I'm not going to be here for the next 2 weeks. I'll be in New Mexico. Yes, until they came back on the 3rd of January. The night of the 2nd, we have a wedding in Chicago. And the 3rd. So, what day is that? 6th of February. So our next 6th of January, Feast of the Epiphany. So January the 6th is our next meeting. And I hope by January the 6th to have found a good translation, because like with the Bible, 10 people translate Augustine. 10 different interpretations of Augustine. Nobody's fault, it's just, what do you expect? Everybody translates according to the mind that he has. To find by the 6th of January then a good translation, and then make copies, and we'll keep the cost down to absolute minimum. I want all of you to read St. Augustine's called De Magistro, the teacher. Okay. Because as we have touched on more than once, but since we're now beginning to talk, well, that's called Ignatian apostolate. Ignatian, either evangelization or catechesis. This, by the way, is in the spiritual exercise of St. Ignatius. You do not really know your faith unless you know the fathers of the church. And the total patristics is over 400 volumes. So a dozen lifetimes would be too short to really cover all that the fathers have written. At any rate, that then I'm asking you to be prepared for. Then, as I mentioned before, I hope then, hopefully by the 6th of January, depending on the amount of time the Lord allows me, I want to know how many of you, and of course there are others in other parts of the country. And one reason we're going to Europe is to find both men and women whom, say, the bishops of the diocese that I will visit could recommend as prospective Ignatian or and Marian catechists. So that's what I want to find out. And not a question of, you might say, inquiry or looking into your background, but my plan is that we will have three levels of the Ignatian catechists, even as we are now having three levels of the Marian catechists. And for want of better language, the terms that I've coined are active, contemplative, and affiliate. Which goes back, by the way, again, to St. Ignatius' time. Although unlike St. Francis or St. Dominic, St. Ignatius did not found a contemplative community of Jesuits. Dominic did. Francis did. And in both cases, they were the women, first of all, the followers of St. Francis. What woman was a great follower of St. Francis who became an outstanding mystic? Saint? Okay. Now, here's one. What woman was a follower of St. Dominic and became?
Catherine.
Saint?
Catherine.
Okay. Catherine of what?
Siena.
Okay. Well, you follow, you know, what I'm saying, and this is something also which is desperately needed in the church, the recovery, and I mean recovery, of the contemplative life. The worst hit of all religious institutes in the United States have been the contemplatives, which in a way is the worst tragedy, because once they're hit, God help the church, for they are the sources of just oceans of grace. At any rate, my hope then is that among the men there will be then those who are, and this is, it's God's grace. Different people have different graces. I want to know, and the sooner, of course, the better, as far as I can tell. Ignatius tells us, before you deal with people, before you give them any responsibility, be sure you know whom you're dealing with. Ideas people can have, money you can get, organizations you can create, but persons, only God both creates, and only He gives the grace. So that then, by the spring of next year, that we'll know who belongs where, or some may say, well, thanks, Father, it's really been good coming to your classes, but I really don't think that I belong. Fine. I did tell you the story about Shelley Penner, Father, didn't I? Oh. Well, Shelley, she's 6 foot tall, professional basketball player. and became a Marian catechist, but she had not yet made her 30-day retreat. Chile, it's one of the conditions. So she decided the exact day she was going to start the retreat, 30 full days. Then, about a week later, she calls me up. Father, what am I going to do? I just got a letter from Tokyo. They want to hire me. It was a year's contract to train their Japanese women athletes. Shelley's a professional basketball player. So I said, very simple. You tell the people in Tokyo that you want, at no charge, at least three times a week, at least a half an hour each time, you call from Tokyo to Detroit. You make your 30-day retreat in Tokyo. And get enough time off to pray. See, you've got important business, which this is. Well, if somebody can find the story for me, I'd appreciate it. I saw it. Somebody borrowed the magazine. I never got it back. Inside the front cover, I think it's a January issue of Sports Illustrated. Inside cover is a picture of Shelley Pennefather with a basketball over her head. And she's standing under a marquee in which it says, starring Shelley Pennefather. And the story is that Shelley decided to give up a $200,000 contract for, basketball with a professional team to enter the Poor Clares. So I offered Mass for the community, and during the homily, I couldn't miss Shelley in the back of the chapel, saying about the tallest thing in the convent. I met with her behind a grill. You know what I'm saying? A 30-day retreat is meant to enable you to make a lifetime decision. All of you must make, no matter what level of Ignatian catechist you're going to be, or if you're women, Marian catechist, you must make a 30-day exercises. There's no option. So that by the spring of next year, we'll know whom we have, who either we don't have, or whom we might maybe get. Letting me, there's work to be done. With that as a background, I would like to now pick up where we left off on the Holy Eucharist. First, may I ask, who remembers where we left off? I was going to begin.
Yes.
Okay, that helps. Well, what I call this when I first gave it was a Eucharistic retreat. It would then be a series of, call them theological meditations, on the real presence. There are 26 sessions, or call them lectures if you wish, or better, I think meditations. I might also tell you that. And what I will share with you will be, of course, directed to you. But this 26 meditation retreat is on videotape, just for the record. It is on videotape. And if you're interested, is available. That's why I will be, by the way, this year end in Jemez Springs, New Mexico, a monastery of nuns called Enemies of the Precious Blood, founded some 40 years ago by a priest who founded two communities, one of men, 12 priests who were in trouble, and a women's community, contemplative community, to pray and sacrifice for priests. That's their vocation. Adoration, exposition of the Blessed Sacrament, 24 hours a day, except, of course, for Mass time. It will now be, I believe, 19 years that I've been going there, except one winter when I was hospitalized with heart surgery. In other words, this is on the real presence. It'd be a combination of both theology as doctrine and spirituality as living the doctrine. One of my favorite definitions of the spiritual life is living what we believe. This is by way of introduction. There will be three essential parts to this immense subject of what we're calling Eucharistic Retreat, Eucharistic Meditations, Course in Eucharistic Doctrine. And over the years in teaching, 25 years in teaching my own Jesuits their theology, I told them, and of course, in most cases, they were either already professional teachers with doctorates, or they'll be teaching after they finish their theology. I don't never just teach class to instruct the mind, never. And the other is never. Always teach in such a way you enlighten the mind in order to inspire the will. That is my definition of a good teacher. That's why God gave us a mind. Gave us a mind in order that we might know what to choose. The will does the choosing, but the mind had better provide the wherewithal for the will to choose. There will be then three parts. Part one will be, what do we believe? When do we believe in the real presence? When I'm speaking of parts, I don't mean necessarily one, two, and three in chronological sequence, but one, two, and three in one, two, and three in logical sequence. In other words, always in mind, it'll be to ask ourselves the three most important words in the English language. In teaching, the what, the why, and the how. What do we believe, when we believe, in the real presence? And is that ever important today? No words can begin to describe the importance of knowing what do we believe. Because of the massive confusion, and sadly, even in otherwise learned, even professedly, professional Catholic circles. Secondly, why did Christ institute the Holy Eucharist as his bodily presence on earth? Why? And by now, depending on how much you want to read, you can find, I'm not exaggerating, 100 reasons. And they may be valid in their own way, but there must be some underlying, what I call foundational reason. Why did Christ institute the Holy Eucharist? And thirdly, how? How are we to put this mystery of our faith into practice. And then on the how, I have three parts. And by now, some of you know, this is the training that I got from St. Ignatius. Whatever you can, divide into three in honor of the Holy Trinity. So I've restrained, and I've been doing it ever since. So on the how are we to put into practice this mystery of our faith? First, in our own personal lives. Secondly, as members of families, whether a domestic family of father, mother, and children, or the spiritual family of, say, an institute of consecrated life, or the family of the mystical body of Christ. And thirdly, how are we to put this mystery of our faith into practice in our apostolate to others? Whether, and when I used these notes, I was speaking to a larger audience, whether we are priests or deacons or religious, or, and I trust I'm talking to the right audience, or dedicated members of the laity. I cannot tell you how much your presence means to me, more than you'd ever guess. I see the future of the church in your hands. I mean it. And not just as an interim tiding over the crisis. No. For the centuries of the future. Then, a concluding observation. This is still all introduction. I make bold to say that we take this Eucharistic series of meditations to heart and implement what we learn in our individual and social lives. We will make a major contribution to the sanctification of the church, to our own sanctification and to the extension of Christ's kingdom, not just in our country, but throughout the world. The 4 hours that I think I told you I spent, 86 and 87, with Holy Father's secretary, you don't know how Father believes without the recovery of faith in the real presence among Catholics in America, he fears for the survival of the Catholic Church in our country. Because God, as we've said more than once, God became man for two reasons. That he might be able to die. God as God cannot die. He might be able to die. Became a man. He had a human body and soul that could separate and cause his death. First reason. And that reason is, part of our history. Second reason, God became man to remain among us as man on earth. And that's a present reality. To know that is to be a Catholic. Not know that, no matter who you may be in the church, you're not a Catholic. And that's what is on trial. How well I know in the church today. By the way, do we have a box for questions? Our first reflection will be on the institution of the Holy Eucharist. As we begin our reflections on the Holy Eucharist, we must first make clear that Christianity is a historical religion. Let me tell you, that's awfully, and I mean it, awfully important. Christianity is not mythology, like the religions of ancient Egypt, Babylonia, Greece, and Rome. Over the years, I've taught courses on each of these religions. Semester course on Egyptian religion, semester course on Babylonian religion, semester course on Greek religion, semester course on Roman religion. Those religions of ancient Egypt, Babylonia, and so on were not historical. There never was a Zeus or a Jupiter, and for sure neither Zeus nor Jupiter became man. Secondly, Christianity is not the product of religious imagination, like Hinduism, Buddhism, or the tribal religions of Asia, Africa, and South America. And again, over the years I've taught courses, even graduate courses, in Hinduism. By the way, to my own Jesuits from India. So we've been back to India, they know something about Hinduism. Thirdly, Christianity is not a cult like Mormonism or Theosophy or Scientology or the New Age or the Jehovah's Witnesses. One of the women in the lectures that I gave to the Missionaries of Charity yesterday, one of the ladies after the class brought me, just to think of even bringing it, a neatly bound, do you have it downstairs? Book published by the Jehovah's Witnesses. All kinds of quotations from Scripture. And when I get it, I can show you what it's like. And this is what we Catholics have got to get hold of ourselves and not be, if I can use the word, taken in by the, what are they calling it? Well, the dream culture in which we're living. I think I told you, my statistics are that 89% of all the reading, of all the books that Americans read in a given year, last statistic I saw, of all the books written, read by Americans in a given year, 89, make it 90%, are fiction. In other words, people are living in an unreal world. The definition of truth is conformity of mind with reality. But you must first, what John said, assume that there is reality. Christianity, therefore, is not any one of these cults. New Age is. But it's fiction in religious language. Christianity has a historical foundation, historical beginnings, and has a verifiable history over the centuries. There was a Jesus Christ, lived in a specific place and time. And among the evangelists, by the way, the one who is best for giving you the historical framework for Christianity is St. Luke. Luke, both in his Gospel and in his Acts of the Apostles. The greatest man who ever lived inside cover, Watchtower Bible and Tract Society, first print in English, 4 million copies. And then, this is a cult. There are 133 short chapters. The lady who gave this to me just marked, yes, page, oh, this something has no pages. All the sections are numbered. This is section 1, the greatest man who ever lived. Jesus never claimed to be God, but he acknowledged that he was the promised Messiah, or Christ. He also said he was God's Son, not God, italicized. And then, referring to John 4:25, 26, and John 10:36. You want to either scream or weep. And these are people I can, well, you know, talk about zeal. And this is Rome's information to me. And among the Latin Americans, 40 million that lost to the Catholic Church since the close of the Second Vatican Council, the single most effective are the Jehovah's Witnesses. When I talked about Americans living in a dream world, I think most Catholics are living in a dream world. They don't really know what's going on. Christianity is not a cult. Can you imagine 4 million copies of this one book? That costs money. And the people there, because it's in Brooklyn, blocks long, there are huge buildings in Brooklyn, New York. Most of those people, and they want to do it, work for a mere pittance. And over the years, as you know, one of the reasons why so many women's communities have gone under is because they said they were being treated like, well, like children. Not being paid a just wage. It is no coincidence, given all that we're saying, that by now the whole human race follows the calendar of Christianity. They have here copyright 1991. Yeah. If we had courts in our country that were still, shall I say, rational, the Jehovah's Witnesses could be sued for daring to use 1991, which is Anno Domini, and yet deny that Christ is the Lord. There's only one meaning for Kyrios in Greek, Dominus in Latin, and that is God. This is 1992, in the year of the Lord, who is God become man. One reason I'm asking you to, and keep, by the way, every time we meet, I ask you, I would like to say, I'm telling you, I don't want you with a verb, I order you to bring copies of parish bulletins. And when I hear about Protestant preachers being invited to speak at the Sunday masses in Catholic churches,